Hello and good afternoon, everybody, if you're in Asia, and good morning if you are in Europe. It's my absolute pleasure to be with you all today. My name is Harriet de Sweet, and I'm part of the brand learning team in Singapore, and I'm also vice chair of the Marketing Society for Southeast Asia. Welcome to our second webinar, Leading in Uncertain Times. And these, of course, do continue to be uncertain times, whether you're emerging from circuit breaker, as we are in Singapore, or whether you're desperately waiting for restaurants to open in England. We are all in very different places in that journey. But the next hour is really an hour just for you, just to take some time, just to pause and to not worry about all those frenetic emails, but just to take some time to reflect and to think about yourself as a leader through the challenging times that we're in. If you were with us on the first session, you'll remember that was all about the future that we need to create as leaders and how we inspire and engage people in that journey. Today, we're going to talk more about engagement, and we're going to really talk about how we bring the organization with us, because of course, this has become much easier with technology, but in some ways much harder. And one of the areas that we always talk about on the Marketing Leaders Programme is that actually, in reality, as marketeers, we can pretty much do nothing by ourselves. We can only achieve the goals that we need to for our consumers with our colleagues with us on that journey. So, in terms of what we're going to do in the next hour, so very shortly, I'm going to be joined by a dear friend and colleague and a fellow board member from the Marketing Society in Singapore. Dom's going to talk with us a little bit about what it means to engage colleagues based on his experience and his career. We're then going to open it up for a Q&A. And so do please type any questions that you've got in the chat while Dom and I are doing our fireside chat or whatever the Zoom equivalent is. And at that stage, when we do the Q&A, Russell's going to join us. So Russell is a colleague of mine at Brand Learning based in the UK, and he heads up the leadership practice, and he runs the Marketing Leaders Programme globally for us in conjunction with the Marketing Society. Russell's then going to take us through some of the tools that we use on the Marketing Leaders Programme that are really relevant to engage. So it's a little bit of investment for you in equipping you to use some new tools that that can help you in this agenda. And if you're an alumni of the program, welcome back. It's lovely to have you with us. And it'll be a really nice opportunity for you to refresh and remind us some of those core concepts you learned about on the program. And then finally, we'll do another Q&A panel so that you can ask us, or indeed ask each other, about anything that you want to talk about. So first of all, I'm going to welcome Dom and ask Dom to turn his camera on and join me on the screen. Thank you, Dom. Lovely to have you with us. So,
It worked.
first of all, Dom, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself? Because you have a somewhat illustrious marketing leadership career, and then I've got a couple of questions to ask you.
So good afternoon, good morning, everybody. I'm Dominique Touchaud. I'm now a P&G alumni due to the 17, 18 years I spent with P&G in various continents in the world. I've had a career before P&G in advertising agencies, and back in January, I started my own consultancy out of Singapore, which offers marketing as a service to companies that cannot or do not want to hire a senior marketer but still want to get the benefits of 20 odd years of marketing knowledge. I've worked all across the continents with P&G. I have never lived and worked in my own native country. I am French by birth, but I come from the French Caribbean. So I have a mixed background. I'm married to a Kiwi lady to make things even more difficult. I chose the furthest country on the planet, and we have three kids born in three countries. So in terms of engagement, everything I'm going to say is heavily influenced by the journey I've taken around the world 25 years ago.
Great, thank you, Dom. And for those of you who aren't familiar with life in Singapore, whilst Dom sounds incredibly exotic, and indeed he is, actually one of the joys of living here is the kind of path that Dom's described, that there are lots of people with this wonderful global perspective. So thank you, Dom. That will really bring a richness to what we talk about. So first of all, if you think back across your time in P&G, maybe across kind of the most recent 5 or 10 years, What do you think helped you really engage your colleagues, particularly when you were trying to change direction, when you were trying to take people on a new journey, either about your brands or your category or strategy? Or what were some of the, what helped you through that?
So I learned very early on, joining P&G is a bit like joining the army. You start in one country, and then after 2 years, your boss calls you and say, hey, I've got a great job for you. It's in Chile. Do you want to go to Chile? You don't speak a word of Spanish, but hey, Chile is a nice country and they're good skiing there. So off you go. And you arrive in Chile, you don't know the language, you don't know the people, you don't know the markets, but somehow you're in charge and everybody's looking up to you and saying, what do we do now? And you realize that I've made that mistake in my first transfer abroad, which was actually in Switzerland, which was the less exotic, where I came with a plan. And when the team looked at me and said, what do you want to do now? I said, that's the plan. And now we're going to execute it. And it was a total failure. So I've learned firsthand that don't come with a plan. I have, with experience, I have a broad direction of where I want to go when I take on a new assignment, but I don't have a plan on how to execute that. So the first thing I do is really, I listen a lot and I try to build a connection with everybody in the team that's going to be in charge of executing the plan. Because at the end of the day, the benefit of the seniority is that I'm sitting on at my desk and I'm asking the other to deliver a plan that we're all supposed to agree on. And I need to make sure that I know where they're coming from, because they had a life before I arrived, and they'll be in charge of making the plan come true. You always find in all the teams I managed, I always found somebody who thought that they would have my job. So that's the first person I want to identify. And I want to turn that person into my best ally, because I've also learned very early that you cannot deliver on a mission, you cannot deliver on a change of trajectory if somebody is not on board. So you need to identify who will not be on board and make sure they get on board before you start steering the ship. I would say it's not a hard science. There's a lot of cultural intelligence, which is something I have used extensively all across my career. And not being in my own country, I've realized it actually helped me, not taking anything for granted and not assuming that everybody thought or felt the way I was thinking or feeling. For all of those of you who are English speakers on the webcast, it's also helped me not to be a native English speaker, because I could always blame my poor mastery of English for not understanding what was going on. But also, it allowed me to let people express themselves in the way they felt was appropriate without being too stuck on words and things that were shared, because sometimes the emotions take over what we want to express.
That's really, so advanced advertisement for one of the tools that Russell's going to be sharing a little bit later in our session, which is going to talk about how you can potentially plot where people are on that engagement. And I think it's a really good point you're making. So you said right at the beginning there that you start by listening, that engagement starts by listening. How do you get people to talk and to open up?
Now, it depends a lot on, I would say, where the person is from. When I was working in Latin America, the way you engage with people is by getting them to talk about their families. And I know it's a cliche, but if you're not interested in what that person does outside of the office, you don't have a connection with them. Mm-hmm. In Asia, on the opposite, if you go to Japan and you start asking them about their personal life, the doors will shut down immediately. So you have to talk about, you have to find something else that person is interested in. So the trick I've been using is to ask each of the team members to come up with something that they want to talk about. And I take it from there. Usually it can be a book, it can be a story, it can be a project. It doesn't have to be related to work, but I want them to come with something that they have a passion for. And that's how I start to try to build a personal relationship. But at the same time, it's not about becoming friends. It's about having a personal connection with everybody before we jump into the business side of things.
So engaging our colleagues and leading across the organization is actually about building personal connections as well as professional ones.
I've seen that the personal connection, at least understanding the personal context, was the providing the necessary background to talk about the professional context. Now, I've been lucky to work with P&G. When you arrive on a new P&G assignment, you have the performance review of the last 15 years of everybody who's going to work with you. So you know exactly what they want to do. You know exactly what they've done before professionally. There's no mystery about that. And as the manager, you have access to all that information. What you don't know is whether they're happy with the situation or not. So before you tell them, we're going to change everything, you need to understand if they think that they're doing pretty fine, or if they think that everything has to be changed anyway, and it just fell on your shoulders, but anyone would have made the transformation. So I'd say that's why I focus on the personal side of things, because the professional side of things, I have enough background information to know exactly where everybody sits.
And do you think that's the same when you're trying to engage cross-functionally across a leadership team, as well as when you're trying to engage with a new team of direct reports?
No, engaging with your peers in the leadership team, I think, is a different story altogether.
Tell us a different story then.
And I would say, sorry, then I will blame my...
No, it's good. It's all good. I'm just interested in that lens, that's all.
I will blame my poor English. P&G is a testosterone fueled environment. When you get into a new lead team, you need to prove that you're worth taking a chair, and you have to go through the phases where everybody is going to call you by the name of the person who is having that chair before you. You need to be ready not to take anything personally. And be somehow co-opted by the team. And I have to say, P&G has done a brilliant job of gender diversity. But when I started 17 years ago at P&G, it was pretty much the boys' club. And I don't play golf. I don't. I cannot say I play golf. And I don't smoke the cigar. And I don't spend my weekends at the club. So I had to find other ways to earn my seat at the table. And usually one of my bosses gave me the trick that I bring a gift to any leadership team I join. I bring them something that I have worked on before I take the assignment that may or may not be related directly to my field of competency. But I bring them a gift on something I would do, or a kind of advice I would give, or the way I see things, before it's totally tainted by the discussions we're going to have within the leadership team.
Very nice, thank you. So I'm going to ask Don one more question, and then it's an opportunity for you guys to ask. So if you type a question into the chat, then that will really help us moderate it. But usually marketeers are quite chatty people, so it's not usually a problem to get you all to talk up. So Dom, looking forward, so you think about, you know, so when you're as ancient as I am, you're a lot younger than me, but when you're as ancient as I am, the reality is it's a very, very different context, certainly than when I started my life at Unilever. We can have a Unilever versus Procter & Gamble intellectual fight sometime. But looking forward, to what degree do you think it's changing for us as marketing leaders, and how do we need to engage differently going forwards, or indeed not at all? Maybe it's actually all the same.
So I'm a bit skeptical about the new normal, or about the idea that our lives are about to change forever. Having been confined for the past 10 weeks, I can tell you I want my old life back. I don't want anything to change. And as soon as I can, I'll be back on a plane. And I will have my carbon footprint settled, but I will be back on a plane. I don't know what the new norm is going to be. When I look at my kids, I'm thinking, I don't know if their life will be that much different from mine. In the office, what I have discovered, and what a lot of people have discovered, is how valuable personal interactions are. There is so much you can achieve via Zoom, via conferencing. And again, P&G was an amazing company to work with in terms of tools that we could use, because we had these fantastic conference rooms that mimic a normal business room. So we always felt that it was very easy to have a meeting virtually without being physically together. At the same time, especially when you work on a regional or on a global remit, never having any personal contact. For a marketer, never being able to go to your markets, I don't think that's the new norm. I don't know how you can manage regional marketing from the ivory tower in the regional headquarters. So I don't see that change that much. What we will have, what has changed, that when I started, I would pretty much travel for a 2-hour meeting, and that is gone. Now, when I travel, there is a good reason for that, and there's a good business reason for that. So that kind of adjustment has already happened, had already happened, because we had the pressure on travel budgets, and that will get even higher. But I don't think that we're going to completely suppress the need for personal interactions. And as a marketer, I was writing a conference note for that this morning. I think what separates companies like Unilever or P&G from a lot of other marketers is that the marketers in those companies spend an enormous amount of time on the street with consumers, not reading about them, not asking them questions online, but talking to consumers. And I think for marketers, being the voice of your consumers at the table will become even more important than it was in the past 20 years.
Yeah, I think that you can't, as you say, you can't beat walking down a street in Jakarta and actually seeing where people are shopping and what they're eating and what they're drinking and what they're actually talking about. So thank you so much for that. And I look forward to seeing you in Changi Airport soon, or maybe January if we're lucky. Russell, why don't you join us? And then we can, thank you, Russell. That's lovely to have you with us. And I think we've got a couple of questions that I'm hoping you can read it. You can bring in for us.
We have, we've got one come in from, thank you, Nicola Oldfield. So you've mentioned about different teams, Dom. How have you brought together teams, perhaps from diverse backgrounds and in markets unfamiliar to you? And can you share any tips on collaboration? And I wonder if that's in a particular context around how we're now collaborating more in a virtual world.
I have to say, because of the nature of my work, because I was always in a regional capacity. I was part of the corporate marketing group at P&G, so always working in the regional center, never working in the country. And you always had that tension between the local team and the regional team. So bringing the team together was always based on trying to really find a common ground and a common way to share things and discuss things. And again, I get back to that cultural intelligence thing, which I think is a very important tool. So I don't want to advertise for them, but I've also taken a lot of training with the Hofstede Institute, and I've also worked with them, and I'm a consultant for them. I realized that what you can feel intuitively, you need to back it up with a bit of facts and a bit of understanding of how different people react to the same level of information or to the same way of talking. Some cultures like direct discussions. Others like to have a softer approach. So being very aware of that has helped. But for me, the trick, if we're asking about tricks and tips, and that gets back to Ariette's previous question. The only way that has worked for me was by bringing the team physically together for a couple of days, 2 or 3 days. Mm. Have them to have breakfast together. And have them to have dinner together and spend time together. It's a luxury. It's not always possible. These days, it's absolutely not possible. But I see companies being very creative and organizing Zoom cocktails and things like that. But for me, getting people together to spend time together is the only way to gel a team.
I always remember listening to a regional marketing director from Unilever talking about going into markets. You'd go into a market about 1 week every month, and she would spend the first 3 days with consumers, not in the office, but with consumers, and then having dinner in the homes with her teams, because she really wanted to really understand their lives. And I think there's something quite fundamental about eating and drinking with people. I agree with you, John. Mm. Russ, give us another question then.
Okay, here's another one. So you mentioned cultural intelligence. Interesting. I've not heard that one. How do you ensure you have that cultural intelligence when you have to deal with different backgrounds? You're bound to make mistakes from the beginning, no? Any tips?
So you work on it. You work on it and you learn. No, I'll give you a bit of personal history. I come from the French Caribbean. Everybody sees me as a French person. I don't drink wine. I don't eat cheese. I drink rum, and I know 50 different kinds of bananas, but that's my culture. So I'm very aware personally. I come from a mixed family. Everybody thinks I'm white, but I have a black father. So I'm very aware that the way people see you is not necessarily the way you are. And I'm aware of that for me. So I'm very aware of that for the others. It's very easy to fall into cliches and think, oh yeah, that's the German. And we all know how the Germans are. But I'm still very French. So I like to take on the Germans. Sorry for the Germans on the call, but I love Germany. I studied in Berlin. I love Germany, but we all have cliches that come with us. And trying to get rid of those cliches to understand who's the person behind the nationality, behind the gender, is for me the start of cultural intelligence. The rest is the icing on the cake, and you can get better at it. But just understanding that not all the French are the same, not all the Japanese are the same, not all the Germans are the same, and trying to get to the person and understanding what values they have, that you have to be cautious about.
Lovely. There's a difference, isn't there, between, you know, diversity on the surface and then digging below the surface, finding that what makes us think differently and bringing that together, that neurodiversity, I guess, is the power.
I'll give you an example. I have found less diversity working with the teams in China than working with the teams in, say, the Philippines, for instance, because the people I was working with in China have all been educated in American universities. So when we talk business, we use the exact same language. We have learned from the same books. But when you go to the less developed geography in terms of education, or where people don't have access to the American colleges, then you realize that the way people learn about business might be totally different.
Yeah,
I've worked in Africa as well. I've worked in the Middle East. People are not that obsessed with the marketing book or with the marketing fundamentals, and you need to adjust to that. So cultural diversity doesn't mean it's not the Benetton side of things. I don't think that teams are more diverse when you have one person representing each minority, but it's really, what is the cultural diversity? What is the diversity of their own backgrounds?
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's a hot topic at the moment, isn't it? Lots written on that one. I'm just sort of, this isn't, I'm not going in order at the moment, but I think there's a question here which leads on from the last chat, which is, Iris, thank you very much. Here's a question from Germany then. How do you define the common denominator if you have so many different cultures in one team?
It's relatively easy if you work for a company that has a very strong corporate culture. And that was the case with P&G, because P&G has such a strong corporate culture that you don't work for a company like that if you don't share the values of the company. So you may have a different approach to those values, but you have to share the values of the company. I don't know anyone who stays 10 years in a company, everybody, every day going into the, going through the doors and thinking, I don't like that company. So you have that common ground. Yeah. And from that, you build on where do we stand on each thing. For instance, the idea of sustainability is not top of the agenda everywhere. And you have to accept that. Doesn't mean you have to give up on it, but you have to accept that in a developing country, it may not be the first thing people will want to focus on.
Yeah.
And you adjust that part, but the corporate culture gives you the common ground.
Yeah, lovely. And we talk about that on MLP, and we talk about the importance of having a North Star and a purpose. And we talk about the importance of, and we talked about it on the last webcast, actually, importance of knowing what it is that you're leading for, but then connecting that to how you're going to create value for your customers, and then aligning the team underneath that. So it sort of creates that common denominator, I think, that Iris was talking about and that you're talking about there, Don. So yeah, lovely. So changing tack slightly, conversations on virtual meetings, obviously lots of people talking about this at the moment, and Connects tend to be dominated by few individuals, and the younger members in the team tend to be much quieter. So this is really important, isn't it, when we think about diversity and the difference of thought that different generations can bring. But how do we ensure that we bring younger people that may be a bit quieter on calls into the conversations? Challenges on virtual meetings also limit to one conversation at any one time. Any suggestions or thoughts on this?
So I'm going to sound like really an old git now, because I realize I have a lot of tricks in the back, but there's something that has always worked, is that there's always somebody who's leading the meeting, and it falls on that person to make sure that everybody has a say, that everybody's talking at some point. And it's really the meeting leader who has to make sure that everybody can talk. And it's relatively easy with a bit of experience to realize that somebody is not participating. And I get back to understanding the person before understanding the business manager. If you know that somebody is very shy, you know they will never volunteer to take the word in a Zoom meeting with 20 people. But it's up on you, on the team leader, to make sure that that person provides their perspective. Now, what I've also learned is that with some people, either because they don't master the language enough or they don't think they speak well enough, they would never speak in public. So you have to make sure that you reflect their point of view separately. So in my last team at PNG, I knew there was one of my best team member who would never speak in public. I would ask him his opinion before the meeting. And then during the meeting, I would reflect on his opinion and see if there was agreement or disagreement on that opinion. Because asking him to speak was an impossible task.
Yeah, it's ironically one of the things that I've really enjoyed about this strange time that we're in, is how people have been able to use technology to connect in a completely different way. And I'm finding there are lots of people in my team that would never have verbally spoken before, but are quite happy to type. So you can get a chat conversation going rather than a verbal one. And actually, I think that's fine. If they're using the channel that works for them to best express their views or to ask questions or to challenge, then actually if technology has given them another channel, that's great.
I was looking at the little numbers that appear now in the chat box. I was thinking that's an amazing tool, because then you're part of the conversation, exactly. But you don't have to raise your hand and you don't have to say, hey, I want to talk.
Yes.
It's very easy, and it's real time.
It is, and particularly I find, for example, with our work in Japan, actually it's hugely liberating for our Japanese clients and colleagues. It's much easier for them than having to actually raise a hand. I agree with you. Russ, I'm conscious of time, so I wonder whether Dom and I drop off and give you a full stage just for a few moments to give us some hints and tips and tools to deconstruct some of the wisdom from Dom. And then the three of us can come back in and we can do another panel kind of Q&A kind of conversation later on. And we'll keep, so do keep asking questions. It's absolutely fine. We just want to give you a little bit more content to be able to structure the conversation later on.
Great. Thanks, Harriet. Thanks, Dom. Okay, so Harriet and Dom will be back shortly, and we do still have questions in the chat and in the Q&A that you posted, so we will come back to those. But just a quick interlude then, if you like. So just to remind us of what this webcast series is all about. It's about leading in uncertain times. And last time, if you were on the first webcast that we did, we talked about the importance of future, the importance of having a future in mind that you're leading for, being clear on what it is that you're leading for. And it's really crucial in times of uncertainty that people have that clarity. So I'm just reminding you of that, to say, bring that clarity in whichever way you can. Okay, so often it's really hard to bring clarity in times of uncertainty. But I would say, if as a leader, if you're a leader of teams, or if you don't have the position of leader, but perhaps you have the disposition of leader, think about how do you bring clarity in this time of uncertainty. And I mentioned the last time we were together, if you were on the call, that I talked about the analogy of driving. So if you're driving along and your people and your teams are in this situation, in this time, it's a bit like the rain is coming down heavily and you're driving, or it's a bit like the fog has come down. And what happens if the fog comes down, or if there's driving rain and you're trying to drive in it, you take your foot off the gas. You tend to be more cautious. And I think it's a useful analogy to think about. So think about that in the context of your leadership. So the first thing to think about in terms of bringing others with you, engaging others and leading in this time of uncertainty, is bring clarity in whichever way you can. Dom talks a bit about, having that something that binds the team. And ideally, that should be your company culture and your company values. And I know there are one or two questions on that. We can come back to that later. But perhaps that's something that you could use to really galvanize and bind your team. So if you're clear on what it is that you're leading for, you've got to bring others with you. So leadership is a team sport. You can't do it on your own. You've got to bring others with you. So the question is, how are you going to do that? So a big question I've got for you, and I've got a few questions for you actually, but the big question for you is, if you're clear on what it is you're leading for, what is the difference that you're here to make as a marketing leader? It might not be sort of some great big altruistic purpose, but just be clear on the difference that you are here to make, it with your brand or with your company. Once you're clear on that, the big question for you is, who is with you? Yeah, who is with you? Who is behind you? And what I mean when I say who is with you, I mean, who is 100% passionately committed behind what it is that you're leading for? So I'll leave you with that for a moment to think about who's with you. You'll probably be thinking about your team members. You might be thinking about peers. You might be thinking about your boss or your boss's boss, maybe wider stakeholders, but who's with you? And now here's another question that I'd like you to write the answer down to. Who would you like to have with you that isn't? Okay, so who's with you on the journey, but who would you like to have with you that isn't? And the importance of that question comes in just thinking a bit of stretch and ambition around who you'd like with you on this journey. So who would you like with you that could really make a difference? Who is there in your company? Who is there in your brand team, perhaps, or the wider sort of stakeholder network, that if you had them on board, if you had them 100% committed to what it is that you're leading for, what is the difference that they could make? And, you know, if you had them with you and they were 100% passionately committed behind, what is possible then? Have a think about who that person could be. I'd love to write that name down. Or it might be a group of people. It might be a team, perhaps. Now, I'm going to share a couple of tools with you that we use on MLP. And Dom has very helpfully already sort of signposted and signaled a couple of these. So a useful thing that we talk about, and it's in the book, actually, that we use on the program. It's called Leadership Plain and Simple. Got a copy on my bookshelf. It's kind of the handbook of the program, really. And in there is this thing called the ladder of engage, or the partnership spectrum, however you'd like to think about it. And what that looks like is something like this. Okay, so it's the ladder of engage. And with that person in mind, or with those people in mind, that team in mind, use this as a bit of a diagnosis tool to think about, okay, well, if that's who I'd like with me on the journey, how engaged are they in that future that I'm leading for? How engaged is that person or that group or that team in what I'm leading for? Genuinely, be honest with yourself. Are they even aware of what it is that you're leading for? Are they asleep to it? They might be very alive to other projects and other initiatives and other things that other people are leading for. How awake are they to what it is that you're leading for? Okay. And genuinely, if you can honestly sit here and say, actually, I haven't really engaged them in a conversation, then perhaps they are towards the bottom of this ladder of engage. Or perhaps it's a team, you know, perhaps it's your team, it's a team within a team. Are they just going along with it? Do you sense that there's just a bit of, perhaps a little bit of apathy and they're going along with it, if you're really honest? Or are they passionately committed? And that's what we're aiming for. If you've got people who are passionately committed, that's fantastic. The challenge then is, how do you keep them passionately committed, right? So use this. Write it down if you've got pen and paper, if you think it's useful, with that particular person in mind. And be honest with yourself and plot where you think they are on this ladder of engage, okay? Are they asleep to what it is you're leading for? Are they going along with it? Or are they genuinely passionately committed? So once you've sort of used that as a diagnosis, the big question then is, how are you going to help them climb that ladder? I think a great way of thinking about that, a great lens to think about that, is what we call the four energies. And we talked about this a bit last time, and I know Chris Ferris-Brown shared it in a webcast quite a few weeks back, so it may not be particularly fresh in your memory. And Dom very helpfully talked about ways to engage different types of people, different cultures. So Dom talked about, you know, cultures in the East are perhaps more of the head and require a little bit more sort of intellectual buy-in, whereas cultures from the West perhaps buy in a little bit more emotionally with the heart. Huge generalizations, obviously, but have a think about the four energies and how you then can engage that person or that group and help them climb that ladder of engage. All right, so if they're not fresh in your mind, they may well not be, these are the four energies, okay? Again, we share these on the MLP. This is a fantastic little tool to think about, something just to have in your mind in terms of how you manage your own energy. And we talked quite a bit about that last time in the last webcast. Now we're thinking about it from the perspective of others. So how are we going to use these four energies, or energy, perhaps, if it's one of them that's important, to help others climb that ladder of engage and be with you? Be as close to passionately committed as you can possibly get them. Imagine what's possible then. So if it's your team, for instance, let's give you a couple of examples. So if it's your team, are they exhausted right now? I know there are lots of people, lots of teams who are just exhausted by circuit breaker, lockdown. Yeah, they're physically exhausted. If that's you, if that's your team, what can you do to help build their physical energy? What are their hopes for the future? So this is where we think about spiritual energy. What are their hopes for the future? Is there a sense of possibility? Or have they lost sense of possibility? I know lots of businesses are operating in very, very different ways now. And people can't, you know, again, the mist has come down and it's less clear what the future looks like. How clear are you on what the future looks like? Where is the sense of possibility? Okay, really important. Or it might be, I mentioned your boss or your boss's boss, or it might be a wider group of stakeholders. What is it that engages them? Where do they come from in terms of their background? Are they head or heart people? So it's not always an emotional connection that you need to build to bring others with you. Often it's important, and there is a sort of a bedrock of emotional connection you need in order to bring everyone with you, I believe. So we're all human beings at the end of the day. But some people are predisposed to requiring a little bit more of an intellectual hook in order to bring them with you. So what is the story that you're telling that is helping bring others with you for what you're leading for? Yeah, so think about that person, that group, that team that you wrote down on that piece of paper. Where are they on that ladder of engage? And how can you use the four energies, or one of the four energies, your combination of the four energies, to help them climb the ladder and help them be with you? What do they need to hear? What do they need to feel from you? Okay. So my last question before we go back to your questions, do keep them coming. If anything comes up, there are questions still in there from the earlier conversation with Dom. My last, I think it's a challenge for you now. Okay, my last challenge is, what is the one thing that you will do to bring others with you? And have a bit of ambition and some stretch in that, in terms of who you'd like to bring with you. What is one thing that you can do now as you come off this call? Is there an email that you've kind of had in the back of your mind that you'd like to send but hadn't quite got round to? Is there a phone call that you'd like to set up, a meeting that you'd like to set up? Share your vision and share that future that it is you're leading for. Maybe it's that, maybe it's something else. But what I'd love you to do is just to write down that one commitment and make that to yourself, okay? All right, a couple of tools that we use on the MLP. There are obviously lots of others that we use in the Engage module of MLP. And we're still here for another 20, just under 20 minutes to take all your questions, and we'll do our best to answer them. I'm going to invite Harriet and Dom back now, and we're going to have a look at the questions that have come through in the chat and the Q&A. So let's just come back here. So actually, this one builds quite nicely on from what I've just covered and something that you talked about, Dom, which is this notion, this idea of authenticity, bringing your authentic self. And what this person's saying is this can sometimes cause friction, potentially, if you're bringing your authentic self. And I often hear about this question, actually, from leaders is, you know, what version of me should show up? You know, so am I just my warts and all the time, or how do I sort of show up? And this person goes on to say, where do you draw a line between keeping your authentic self and work with all the different backgrounds that you need in order to bring others together? They're thinking about allowing an open space for everyone while you still have everyone express their true selves respectfully. So how do you establish that? Any thoughts on that? Bringing your authentic self, and when is it appropriate, when is it not? How do you open space for others whilst bringing your authentic self?
So I have that answer for me is very, very personal, because it depends how you want to be perceived, but also depends on your personal values. I spend so much time in the office that I cannot imagine that I would be a different person than at home than in the office. So my personal self, you get it all in the office. If there are frictions, it's part of life. I'm not a huge fan of the Myers-Briggs profiles, for instance, because it says that this type of profile is supposed to work well with that type of profile. I believe that if you put two people who have good intentions together, even if they are not friendly together, they will eventually find a way to work together. This is not the school playground, this is the office. Frictions are part of life. And as managers, we need to be able to handle frictions. We need to be able respectfully to say, we disagree, but we still have to work. And in that case, either I'm the boss and we disagree, but I have the upper hand, or I'm not and we disagree, and I will execute the plan, but I will make sure that I've expressed my disagreement before. And for me, that's the authenticity. The one rule I've always stuck to is that I never say something that I don't believe in to try to second guess or please the manager. And I got that from the CEO of P&G at the time, A.G. Lafley, who said, I never got promoted because I agreed with my boss. I got promoted because every time I had an opinion, I was able to explain why I had that opinion. He didn't say I got promoted because I always agreed or because I always won all the arguments, but because he had opinions backed up by thinking. And for me, that's the business context.
I think that's absolutely right. And I'm a great believer in the need for the real need for a healthy tension, actually, because I think if you spend too much time in comfort, in that comfortable space where things are easy, everybody gets along, then I really don't believe that's the place for growth. I think leaders need to inject that kind of healthy tension to get those different thoughts and different opinions that can feel a little bit uncomfortable at times, but that's the way you stretch each other and stretch thinking and create new things. Basically, I don't think we can create new by agreeing with each other too much. So sometimes you need that little bit of healthy tension and for it to feel a little bit uncomfortable at times.
I think it's a lovely question, and there's a piece for me about being deliberate about it and being conscious about it as well. So I've just joined a new team, and for the first time ever in my career, in nearly 30 years of work, I'm the only woman, which is extraordinary in marketing. And it's a very, to your point, Dom, about P&G, it's a very testosterone culture compared to the culture that I've been in before. And I've had to make quite a deliberate decision about how to respond to that and how to show up and what to really hold on to about that I believe in the way that I want to lead and where, frankly, do I need to adjust accordingly. Yeah. So
Yeah.
There's a question, I think, from Rada Russell, which I think would be nice to pick up on. And lovely to have you with us, Rada.
Great minds and all that, Harriet. Thank you. I was just about to pick that up, actually. Thanks, Rada. So we have some new starters who joined just before lockdown. This is, I'm guessing, in Rada's team. Haven't had the opportunity to get to know them well yet. How do you work out which energy to focus on to be successful with them? Are there any tips and tools that you've used, Dom, to help get to know a team? What makes them tick? What helps drive them? What energies to tap
into? There's something really interesting that happened in the past 5-6 months, that there are people I've hired at P&G who joined when I was leaving. And I always told them, I'll be there, call me whenever you need. And they've kept calling me. And the challenge is that they called me more than they were calling their current boss. And I realized that if you start your career in that COVID context, you don't have the luxury to build that personal connection. You never spend time with each other. You don't travel. You're not on the plane in that Nagoya Airport at midnight. So you don't have these personal stories to build upon. So the only way that it can work is by spending time with your team members. And then just identifying through conversations what is the type of energy they react to. And I really liked your quadrant, because as I said before, some people need facts. They need to know that the manager knows more than they do, that the manager has a vision, that the manager could, and others need to know that the manager is a cool dude. I don't like the word dude, but my kids use it the whole time. So I've used it. But you realize very quickly what everybody wants to have, the type of relationship they want to have. Some want an authority, others want a peer they can talk to. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as the leader, you need to make sure that everybody understands you're managing the team. Mm-hmm. In these days, I don't know. I'm a one-man show right now, so I don't have a team to manage. I don't have that, but I'm still mentoring somehow the 3 or 4 assistant brand managers I hired in the past year who are now working for P&G and don't have a connection with their managers. And what I've done, quite frankly, is call their managers, say, "Hey, I think you should call them once a week, at least, just to check on them, see if they're doing fine. How come they were late to give that memo back? How do they feel?" The confinement has had an amazing impact on all of us mentally as well. Mm. We cannot ignore that, especially for people who start their career and have no frame of reference with regards to what is a normal business environment.
Mm. Mm, yeah, lovely. Thanks, Dom. And I think just to build on that, this is something we use on the program. And you might want to, rather in response to your question, it's something that you could do. So you can use this. A really simple thing. There are other tools and, you know, psychometrics that you can use, like insights, etc. But if you're after a really simple thing to do that gets people together and gets people talking, what gives you energy? What drains your energy, your physical energy? What gives you emotional energy? What drains your emotional energy? What gives you intellectual energy, mental energy, and what drains it? And you can go around all of them and invite people to think about it and to share with each other. Just gets the conversation going, and you get a much better idea of what it is that drives people and what you can tap into as a leader.
I've really asked Russell for that type of things. If you had asked me the question when I was 25, I would have been unable to answer. Mm. This was not the type of things we were discussing. Mm. When I talk to young graduates today, they're very aware of what drives them. Mm. So if you're open and ask them the question straight, what kind of boss do you want to have? Very often they will have an opinion on that. That's that's what I have experienced. That if you ask them how do you want us to interact, I would have when I started, I would have said I don't know, sir. Whatever you want, I'll be good. But that's not the way the new generation works. So right now it's much more open. So I go and I ask the question straight.
Hmm. I think as well, this question about what gives and drains us of energy is much more important now than even 3 months ago. Mm. I think 3 months ago, we maybe thought this was a short crisis. Mm. It's all okay. It's going to be horrible. We're just going to grin and bear it, and then we'll all be back in the office and everything will be okay. And it's now very clear that it's not the situation we're going to be in, let alone the economic impacts of what's coming down the track. So really thinking about how we build and retain energy for the long term, now is a really good time to be having that conversation with people.
Yeah, I agree. More important than ever. Okay, we've got a couple of slightly different questions on the Q&A, I think, just to change the perspective slightly. Dom, you mentioned gifts earlier. Can you give us some examples of these? You mentioned that when you join a leadership team, you bring gifts. And that sounds really interesting. Can you give an example?
Maybe it's a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah.
I don't know. I keep that for later because you don't want to give a bottle of whiskey to someone who doesn't drink alcohol. That would be a big no-no. So I need to check. I've done that mistake. So I check that first. No, but for instance, I can give you an example. I've spent most of my careers working on two main categories. One is baby care, diapers, and the other one is fabric care, which is the P&G mothership that, you know, Tide and Ariel and all of these fantastic brands. And I've realized that Pampers has probably the most advanced digital marketing I've ever seen. So when I joined the leadership team of the fabric care team in APAC, what I brought was a review on the digital marketing done by the baby care business unit, because they had never been exposed to that. And they didn't know what was possible because they didn't know what the guys working at the other end of the corridor could do. So it was just bringing something that I was very comfortable with. So I had the authority on that. But telling them something they didn't know and could give them a new perspective on what was possible.
Yeah.
And also establishing my authority or my credentials in terms of digital marketing, for instance.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, lovely. Thanks, Dom. I think we've probably got time for one more question, Harriet, before we close and wrap up. So, and it's a nice one. So this last one for you again, Dom, in your career, what has your one hardest or biggest failure been, and how did you overcome it? What did you do about it, I guess?
So it was not at P&G. It was when I was working with Swatch, which was, you know, 20 years ago. And I arrived. It was my first job abroad, a really cool brand. And I was the head of advertising for Swatch globally. I was on top of the world, and I was working with four amazing people, all women, by the way, Hyatt. So it was the reverse, like me and Charlie and the Angels, the four girls. It was a total failure. I've always had good relationships with my team. That one was a total disaster. After 6 months, they would go over my head, talk to my boss, and ask them questions that I was supposed to answer. And I sat there and think, what went wrong? In that passage from a very successful position in Paris to a very attractive one in Switzerland, and somehow I've lost the connection. I realized that I went in with my set of ideas, wanting to prove myself and thinking that I would lead by in an authoritarian way. And I realized that was not my style. That was not my character. And that was not what they wanted. Now, for those of you who know Switzerland, the Swiss would vote for everything. So they want to know for everything. They want to be asked their opinions. And you cannot ignore that when you work with a team made of Swiss people, even if they have a very international background. The way I managed it, quite frankly, is that if I'm totally honest, it was a bit beyond repair when I realized what was going wrong. So I just managed to correct the course. But after a while, it was very hard for me to regain ownership of that team. It was not a team that I had chosen. It was a team that I had badly managed. Mm. So if you look at my LinkedIn profile, I stayed at Swatch probably a bit more than 2 years. And the fact that I had started the wrong way was a huge part of that.
Mm. Lovely. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for the honesty. It's Great.
Thank you so much, Dom. It's been an absolute treat with for us to have you with us this afternoon and this morning. And thank you, first of all, to everybody else for participating. We hope that you found this last hour helpful and some time for you yourself. We hope it's been an opportunity just to reflect on your own energy and the energy of your team, and about how you can build relationships and engage others in the exciting visions that you're building for your business and for your brands, and as you lead through the uncertain times that we are in. Coming up next, we have our third webinar coming up at the end of July, which is all about delivery. So once we've got our vision for the future and we've engaged people in that, we're going to be thinking about how do we really make it happen? How do we follow through and how do we execute? Because if we don't execute, then we are simply dreaming and having a nice time rather than actually delivering the results that we're meant to be doing. So thank you so much. Please give us your feedback. So there's a poll that will be coming up. We'd love to hear your feedback, because this is only the two of three. We've got an opportunity to make revisions to our third one. And thank you very much for your participation too. Please do stay in touch. Reach out to any of the three of us. We'd love to hear from you. And in the meantime, have a good evening if you're about not far off a gin and tonic if you're in Singapore. And have a really good day for those of you in Europe that have only just started. And thank you so much again for joining us. Thanks. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.